Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. I'm joined as always by Frank Cogliano. How you doing, Frank?
David, I am tan, rested, and ready.
You're tan? We live in Scotland. How the hell did that happen?
Okay, I'm exaggerating. Anyway, okay. I am ready for the final push to the general election. I'm ready for the start of the academic year. I'm ready to go.
You're ready. Well, that makes one of us. Speaking of the general election, some of the recent rhetoric coming out of the Trump campaign is as Donald Trump, defender of the suburbs. He has tweeted recently that I am happy to inform all people living their suburban lifestyle dream, they're all capitalized, that you will no longer be bothered or financially hurt by having low-income housing built in your neighborhood. And then he ends the tweet by telling people to enjoy, which is an odd take of his. He's also said that suburban housewives of America should all vote for him, and he will, because he says that Biden, if he gets elected, will destroy your neighborhood and your American dream. So suburban lifestyle dream is what Trump is recently saying is under threat by a potential Biden administration.
And in the past 24 or 48 hours, he's bizarrely been either threatening or promising people that Cory Booker in particular will come to their suburbs.
Cory Booker seems like a very nice guy. I wouldn't mind if he came to my suburbs.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're going to get to the racial dimension to a lot of this rhetoric, I'm sure, in the course of the next few minutes. But and clearly, Cory Booker, of course, is African-American. I think most people, the response of many people on social media has been, I'd love it if Cory Booker came to my suburb. But he seems to identify, in his mind, Cory Booker seems to be the apotheosis of the threat that Democrats pose to the suburbs for some reason. As I said, I'm sure we'll unpack some of this in the course of the next few minutes, but he's definitely making a pitch for the suburbs and these, I mean, this use of the phrase suburban lifestyle dream in all caps, it really does sound like post-war marketing in the late 1940s, early 1950s. You could see it on a billboard, you know.
Exactly.
But, you know, come and get your suburban lifestyle dream.
Move to Levittown, right?
Yeah. So he's definitely trying to signal to a certain segment of the electorate, it seems to me, or what he imagines to be a certain segment of the electorate, which is white, middle class people who live in suburbs, and particularly women who, you know, he's polling very badly among white women, especially those with a college education. And it seems to me that he's attempting to target them as archetypal suburbanites. Whether that's true or not is something we may discuss in the next, in the course of this episode.
And the phrase he uses is not suburban women, it's suburban housewives.
Yes,
which has the rhetoric here does seem very much out of the 1950s. Before we sort of dig into the history of suburbs, I think we should establish our suburban bona fides. Frank, have you ever lived in a suburb?
I have. I mean, it's interesting. In researching this episode, David, our two cities of birth, Boston and New York, play crucial roles in the history of suburbs in the beginning. But I grew up, although I was born in Boston and educated in Boston, I grew up, I spent most of my childhood, or all of my childhood, really, in suburbs outside of Boston. So to some extent, I had an archetypal suburban childhood. So this time it's personal, listeners. What about you? You're a Manhattanite.
I grew up in cities, and my experiences of suburbs as a child was largely through television and movies. But as an adult, I've actually lived in suburbs. When I lived in Jacksonville, Florida, I lived in a suburban neighborhood. Actually, most of Jacksonville is a suburban neighborhood. Actually, a very small area that would be called downtown. And then in graduate school and after graduate school, we lived in a suburban community that was one of the first of these post-war suburban communities built in the South, in a place called Parkwood, that was kind of like Levittown for North Carolina, where all the houses looked the same and you knew exactly where your neighbor's bathroom was because it's in the exact same place as your bathroom. I've lived as an adult in suburbia.
Yes, so by contrast, I guess I haven't lived in the suburbs since I left to go to university back in 1983 on a regular basis.
Ah, okay, so we cover different chronological periods and geographies of suburbs then. Great.
That's right, yeah.
So you know, when we think about suburbs, I think you know, it might be helpful to sort of split suburbs into sort of three chronological periods, because it strikes me that the kind of suburbs that Trump is talking about, the suburban lifestyle dream, you know, he's really talking about sort of the post-World War II period, maybe until, I'm going to pick an arbitrary date, 1985, right? I think that's sort of a window of suburban life that I think he's referring to.
I mean, David, I left in 1983, so maybe that was the end of that phase.
Okay, so when Frank leaves, that's the end of that suburban lifestyle dream. I think, you know, the suburbs have changed a lot since you left. you know, because you left, really, it's all.
Yes, that's right. I mean,
that was the beginning of the end for suburbs. I mean, there's other factors probably involved too, but I think
this is a good example of the difference between correlation and causation.
But I think there's also an era of suburbs that sort of precedes World War II. I think maybe we should think about them in those sort of three phases, roughly, if we could. If we were going to say, when's the origin point? When do we have suburbs? We don't have suburbs in the colonial era, do we? When do we first get suburbs?
We get suburbs, you know, I think, in the late 19th century, really. And the cities of our births, respectively, Boston and New York, play key parts of the story in the history of suburbs in the United States, because they're a result of technology and particularly transportation. So Boston is often seen as being one of the – having the earliest kind of experiment in suburban life, places like Newton and Brookline, if you know the Boston area, because of – Boston is the first subway system in the United States, and you get what are called streetcar suburbs in Boston in the late 19th century. You get them in New York as well, but it's with the – spread of streetcars, and then you see this in various other urban areas in the United States. You get the Main Line in Philadelphia. You get the other suburban areas in places like Chicago. So where you get the so-called streetcar suburbs, which are – they would almost be inner suburbs now if we looked at maps of U.S. cities. But so they're quite close to the city centers, but they were reachable by streetcars. And often the people who lived in those suburbs were quite affluent. So it's a little bit of not quite country living, because it's closer than that. But you get people building quite substantial homes, late 19th century homes, in these suburbs that are quite close to the city centers, but removed from them via streetcars. And as I said, Boston was an early experiment in this. In New York in the late 19th century, you get a similar phenomenon, but it's New York, so it's bigger and better. So you end up getting – well, you get a rail network that starts. Yeah. It's proper railways as opposed to just streetcars. So it's, you know, it's the Long Island Railroad. It's the train up to Westchester County. It's the train into Fairfield County in Connecticut, and the trains and tunnels that go to Jersey. And so you get the growth of suburbs.
And ferries.
And ferries, yes, that's right. Yeah. And yep, that's right. And so technology makes this possible, and the geography of New York in particular, because of its nature as an island or a series of islands, it lends itself to this. And so with the advance of technology, you get the creation of these suburbs in the late 19th century. As I said, they're still relatively close to the city center, and they tend to be for the affluent rather. I mean, one of the changes we'll see after the Second World War is that the class dynamic changes. But is that consonant with your understanding, David? I mean, this is your period more than
one. Yeah, well, so, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, it's in these sort of mostly East Coast cities, places like, you know, Richmond and Pittsburgh and Boston, New York and Philadelphia. I mean, the question I have is when we think about the birth of the suburbs in the late 19th century and the role of transportation, and what's the attraction, I think, for these upper class people to live outside of the city then?
Well, city centers are dirty. They're often unhealthy in the 19th century. They're not necessarily terribly dangerous, but they're not as safe as the suburbs are. And I think, you know, they the city centers grow very rapidly in the period from 1890 to 1920. Many of the people who live in those, the growing populations, the burgeoning populations of those cities, are immigrants, often poor, often from Southern and Eastern Europe. And they do not look like the historic residents of many of the cities in question. And so one thing, the kind of unspoken aspect of the suburbs, and Donald Trump is attempting to tap into this, is it's an effort by people with a little bit of means to separate themselves from people they don't like, even if they don't articulate it in such a fashion. So I think that's part of the it's part of the attraction. So you can imagine people moving out to get away from all those immigrants, all those Jewish and Catholic immigrants.
Well, and it's interesting because I think there's also sort of a gendered dynamic to this, because it's, you know, so the thing about suburbs in some ways is it's a place where you live, but not necessarily where you work.
Yes.
Right. And so, you know, these wealthy families who are moving out into the suburbs in the end of the 19th century, you know, it does create a sort of a commuter class of people who live one place and then work in another. But their families, you know, sometimes they're also commuting, but oftentimes they are not. Right. And so it's a way of having, you know, your family's in one place and your work is in another place, and you live in both places, or, you know, simultaneously in a way. And the transportation facilitates that. But it is about, in some ways, about protecting your family from the danger of the city. And obviously the cities are growing exponentially in the late 19th century, you know, population booms in all of these places. And so it's creating sort of an alternative to cities that still is dependent upon the city.
Yeah, I mean, the ultimate kind of physical manifestation of this, to my mind, isn't a suburb itself, but quite the contrary. It's Grand Central Terminal in New York, which is one of my favorite train stations anywhere in the world. But, you know, it's completed in 1913. It'll be familiar to many of our listeners who probably visited New York. And it's amazing because it's massive. And it's got, I think it's 44, there are 44 platforms. So there are trains going everywhere, but they're not actually trains. You know, when you go to Union Station in Washington, you feel like you're in a national capital. You're at a terminus where trains are coming in from different cities in America. So the you know, the Cardinals coming in from Chicago or whatever, when you're at Union Station. When you're in Grand Central, it's really a suburban hub. It's, you know, all those, most of those trains, not all of them, because the Amtrak trains and the Acela do run up and down the East Coast via, although they tend to go by a Penn Station, of course.
They do tend to go by a Penn Station,
But Grand Central is a hub, and it's so busy, and it's beautiful, but it's a hub for the vast suburban network out of the tri-state area outside of New York City, and it's a kind of manifestation of that separation you're talking about. And it plays such an important cultural role in films and TVs about this sort of, there are the people who come in and go out of the city for their work, and then there are the people who live in the city. And that's the fundamental thing that's created by suburbanization. And you're right, there's an important gender dimension to that, because at least in the early, in the period we're talking about, when affluent families are moving out of the city, it tends to be the man who's the one who's commuting in and out of the city. Not always, but tends to be.
Okay, so, you know, we have this sort of prehistory of suburbs, but if we're talking about sort of the golden age of suburbs, I think we're really talking mostly about this, I guess the image that Trump is evoking is the post-World War II period. And I think what we've got there is a confluence of a variety of things that are really sort of making the suburbs happen. What do you think about some of the sort of the factors that they're making the 50s sort of the golden age of suburbs, Frank?
Well, I think there are a number of things. First of all, you get the housing and population boom right after the Second World War. We should start with the population boom that leads to a housing boom. You get the increased wealth and the kind of the spread of wealth kind of down the social scale in the United States after the Second World War and after the Depression. So there's this real pent-up demand for housing, and there's greater access to capital, both to build houses, but also via the GI Bill and things like this. There's a social leveling that's going on. And so working class people and lower middle class people can now aspire to a suburban lifestyle that had previously been denied to them, frankly. Their predecessors, their parents had lived in urban areas. Now they can.
And had rented in urban areas.
That's right. So, and now home ownership becomes the ideal. And technology, of course, plays a part in this too, because the spread of railroads and subways and so on makes it possible. And of course, car ownership and the spread of the interstate highway system means that it's easier to commute by car. And so all the elements that we associate with suburban life are falling into place. The way we buy things in the United States, or people buy things in the United States, the shopping malls and shopping centers emerged really, in the 1950s, replacing big city center department stores. And crucially, let's not forget the great migration of African Americans from the South to the North, that Isabel Wilkerson, among others, has written about so poignantly, happens during the first decades of the 20th century. And that's a driver as well to drive many, again, lower middle class and working class whites with a bit of means out of the cities, because there's a degree of segregation that's both explicit in suburbs, and we'll probably talk about this, but also implicit in suburbanization as well. And so the suburbs quickly, and we've talked about this in the past, the way that Donald Trump's outlook for the world and for America is really kind of fixed in the 1950s. The suburbs really are a haven for whites of varying degrees of affluence to have the good life, the American dream, however we want to frame it, in a space that's all their own, really. So that's an important dimension of this, especially after the Second World War in the 1950s. Because let's not forget, the 1950s is also the period when the Civil Rights Movement is gaining steam, and suburbanization goes hand in hand. It's not, again, we don't want to confuse correlation and causation, but I think that's a part of the picture as well.
They're not unrelated phenomena.
They're not, right? That's right. That's right.
I think you've hit on sort of most. I mean, the interesting sort of confluence of things that really does sort of lead to suburbanization in the 1950s. And I think one thing has to do with sort of the paucity of housing being built in the previous decade and a half. Basically nobody's building new homes in the 1930s. No one's building new homes in the sort of first half of the 1940s because of the war. And so there is sort of this pent up demand for housing. I found some statistics that in 1944, there's 142,000 new homes built. And a decade later, there's 10 times as many, 1.5 million new homes built in that year. And so, I think there's a boom in production because in part that there had been this sort of this generation of basically no homes being built. And how accessible these homes are in terms of making home ownership something that was affordable for even sort of lower middle class white people, right? So the GI Bill is a big part of that, which sort of made it provided for low cost loans for veterans. The Federal Housing Administration, which was a sort of New Deal program, also made mortgages more accessible to working class people, right? The American model of a 30-year mortgage really sort of starts with FHA programs. And, that allows for somebody to go in with relatively little money down, at least in the 1950s, and be able to purchase a house and a quarter-acre lot and have a sort of an entry point to that kind of market. The rate of home ownership goes from something like 40% prior to Second World War and to up to over 60% afterwards. And I think the suburbs are a big part of that. I think the other big part of it is they start to make really sort of cheap mass-produced houses, right? And I think that's sort of the affordability of houses is a big part of that. Should we talk about Levittown?
Yeah, please.
Levittown is...
Yeah, I've talked a lot, David. Tell us about Levittown. Let me let you start that.
Okay, well, so Levittown is, well, there are actually several Levitt towns, but it's made by sort of the Levitt family, which were a home, building corporation. The most famous of which, the first Levitt town, is in Long Island. And the premise behind this construction company was, instead of building a house, which is the way that most housing construction had been done prior to the Second World War, they're going to build a lot of houses basically on an assembly line model.
It's like IKEA for houses.
Yes, but with even less choice. Because what you would do when you would buy, they would produce that, they'd have a concrete slab, and then they would have, an assembly line essentially of workers put up the walls, and the lumber would have been pre-cut before it even arrived there, so they didn't even have to cut the lumber. The doors would be pre-hung, so they wouldn't have to sort of fit the doors. The windows would be prefabricated, so they could slot those in. The housing would become furnished with appliances, so that it was all sort of designed to be a one-size-fits-all model. And these were not huge houses. They weren't fancy houses, and they all, in some ways, looked the same. In fact, they all, at least initially, did look the same. You may be familiar with the 1962 song Little Boxes, which I think sort of speaks to this sort of uniformity of housing. And in fact, the community I lived in Durham was one of these sort of mass-produced commodities, housing communities. But one of the facets of this kind of mass production is it allowed them to sell these houses at a much lower price. And then when you sort of factor in the availability of the GI Bill and FHA mortgages, it made it an accessible commodity for a young family with a handful of children to be able to purchase one of these, even if they're in their sort of 20s and 30s. And so it made home ownership accessible to a whole segment of the white community that it was previously, closed to. In the initial Levitt town, I think they have something in the order of 10,000 houses built within, the first 4 or 5 years of the community being open. And so they open up different sort of wings, and eventually they decide to have multiple different options you could buy. So they have, first they have two houses you could buy, and then they have sort of three different models. But it really was sort of using this mass production model to sell somebody a fully stocked home.
It's actually slightly more than that, David. It's 17,447 houses built by 1951.
Okay, so I guess that's 4 years after it opens.
Yep.
And the earliest houses were I think $8,000, which obviously this is 1947 money, but it's still, even with compound interest, not a very expensive house. So the barrier of entry for home ownership was particularly low for this sort of at this particular moment, and so it really did provide a really attractive option, and it was an option in which buying a home was cheaper for many people than renting would be, and so it really changed that dynamic in important ways. And I think part of what Levittown was settling was not just the sort of the house and the affordability of the house, but the kind of lifestyle that would go along with it. I guess this gets back to Trump's notion of the suburban lifestyle dream. That this was a place where it would be safe and relatively homogenous. Right. I think that the homogeneity was both the great selling point of the suburban lifestyle dream, and sort of its detractors. The thing that they pointed to was the homogeneity of it. One of the things that people signed when they bought a house at Levittown and bought houses in these other built communities were these restrictive covenants that sort of outlined what you could and couldn't do with your house. And probably the most important one in Levittown was one that prohibited you from selling your house to non-white people. And that I think that sort of you know, the community is telling you what kinds of things you can do with your home and with whom you can, you know, who belongs in that community and who doesn't belong in that community. I think that that's a very important part of this suburban lifestyle dream, is this kind of community regulation of who belongs and who doesn't.
That's right. Sorry. Go ahead, David.
I mean, and there's huge fights about sort of both the legality of these kinds of clauses, but there's also a huge amount of social pressure when people who are not white want to move into these communities to prevent them from doing so. Right. So there's discrimination that happens in the form of realtors, discrimination that happens in terms of getting mortgages, and there's actual sort of threats of violence and actual violence against people who try to move into suburbs when they are not welcomed by the people who already live there. In terms of creating sort of getting back to sort of Trump's rhetoric about low income housing and suburbs, you know, I think that he's actually sort of connected to that restrictive covenant kind of idea, where the Obama era housing regulation that he is trying to get rid of was trying to create a sort of class diversity within suburban communities, and Trump is trying to preserve a kind of homogeneity and a sort of white homogeneity that he thinks still exists in the suburbs.
Yeah, I think there's, I mean, something else at work there, which is, let us never forget that he got his start and his family made its money originally as property developers. Mm-hmm. And so for him, on one hand, suburbs are places, and suburban developments are places that represent wealth, and wealth for him and his family and potential investments. But low-income housing is code for, this is going to damage my investment, or the message he's trying to send to voters, or your investment in your home. You know, he's not subtle about that at all. But that too is very much of the 1950s and 60s, and not true today in the same way. But that's what means to him, I think, when he uses that rhetoric.
Yeah, I think that's right.
The other thing, before we go on, about Levittown and other similar kind of suburban developments that I think needs saying, one of the real appeals of suburbs, and this wasn't about race and things like that, was space. You know, cities were crowded, and cities, cities are crowded, but the appeal of space and the fact that when you see an overhead shot of Levittown from the 1950s or 60s, you know, it looks horrible to us, but everybody's got a lot that's the same size, but everybody's got a lot. And then as suburbs become more and more affluent, the lots you're built, your house is built on, and these aren't semi-detached houses in many cases. They're often, you know, freestanding single homes that have their own space. And the appeal of that space to people is a big part of the selling, is a big part of the attraction.
Yeah, you have a yard, you have a garage, you have a castle of your own in a way.
Yeah, that's right. And that's a big part of the selling point, especially as the population is growing. With the population boom, the post-war population boom, that's a big part of the appeal.
You know, one of the things that happens, you know, and you mentioned this earlier, with suburbs in the 1950s, it is, even while, you know, largely men are continuing to sort of migrate between the suburbs and the city, you know, there's infrastructure that develops in the suburbs that allows people who live in the suburbs to stay in the suburbs, right? So whereas in the late 19th century, people who lived in the suburbs would have to come into cities to shop, the rise of shopping malls, enables people to basically do all their shopping in the suburbs. And so you don't actually have to, you know, you see what you find in many places is the suburbs are flourishing at the same time that cities, the sort of downtown area, is atrophying in terms of its economic opportunities, and you know, shops are shuttering and whatnot in city centers, while you're having economic development happening on the fringes.
or town centers, because many of these suburbs were, you know, older towns
sure.
that had sort of quaint main streets. Those flourish while the center, the central business district in major cities start to deteriorate. You're absolutely right. But a key element of that, of course, is the car. Everybody in suburbs is dependent on car ownership and using cars, because while commuters might go from the suburb to the whatever the local metropolis is via train or subway or maybe car, but the people, in order to live a suburban life, you have to drive, and you need access to a car, and you need and they're set up, whether it's, you know, I remember my mother doing, you know, drive through banking when I was a kid, and
drive through everything.
Yep, drive through everything. But you know, it's entirely dependent on or the suburban lifestyle is entirely dependent in that post-war period on the widespread ownership of automobiles.
Well, and in some ways, what it does is it actually sort of creates structures, you know, which have preserve themselves to the day, where, you know, think about the amount of landscape that is devoted to parking lots, you know, in suburbia, you know, oftentimes the parking lots are multiple times bigger than the shops they are parking lots for, right? And so, again, this is more autobiographical probably than our listeners care about, but, you know, when we were living in suburbia, and while I was in graduate school, you know, my wife would often spend 4 or 5 hours a day in the car, taking children to various things, where you know they would be dropped off and picked up, and she would not leave the car, which sounds like a whole lot of no fun to me, but she seemed to enjoy it. At least that's what she claimed. You know, but there is this whole sort of culture of suburbia I think we need to sort of talk about. I mean, you know, Richard Nixon sort of cited the prosperity of the suburbs and the kitchen debate in 1959, and you know, suburbs are an important part of cultural representations of American families that really sort of starts in the 50s and lasts for a very, very long time. Frank, I know you're a fan of Leave It to Beaver. Do you want to sort of talk about suburbs and popular culture?
Yeah, absolutely. Leave It to Beaver, which might be a TV show that some of our more experienced listeners will remember. It was on American TV from 1957 to 1963. Now, I want to make clear that I did not watch Leave It to Beaver when it first was on television. I'm not that old. But it was on in reruns when I was a kid. And Leave It to Beaver is one of a series of programs that appeared on American television. And, of course, television is integral to the suburban lifestyle. You don't have to live in the city because you have entertainment brought to your home via TV. Television representations of suburbs is something that really interests me. And Leave It to Beaver is a kind of archetypal example of the kind of TV program. It's actually quite funny, but the Cleaver family live in this fictional town, and I spent a lot of time on the internet yesterday trying to find out where it was. There's a lot of people claiming it was in Ohio. Others claim it was based on Skokie, Illinois. It was filmed in Los Angeles, of course, but they live in this fictional town called Mayfield, and it's a suburban family. It's Warden June Cleaver and their two sons, Wally and the younger one, whose nickname is the Beaver. And Leave It to Beaver is a suburban-based kind of family comedy. It's one of the first TV programs in America that presents things from the perspective of a child. So it's actually quite interesting. They are, of course, all white. The world they live in is, it's literally a black and white TV program. But, you know, everybody in Mayfield almost, I think. I mean, I think there are one or two African-American characters over the course of the program. But it's an entirely white suburban existence. And it's quite idyllic. Wally and Beaver get into hijinks and, you know, they get into problems like kids do. But, you know, Beaver gets his head stuck in a fence one episode, this kind of stuff. So it's very tame. It's a very happy marriage. Ward Cleaver, if memory serves, he might be an insurance salesman or agent or something like that. But, you know, he comes home and June is always immaculately dressed and, you know, has dinner ready and, you know, he, you know, hands him his pipe and his slippers while he reads the evening paper. There was an evening paper then, of course, before they have dinner, that kind of thing. So it presents this idealized suburban existence. It's not the only example of this. There are, you know, there's Aussie and Harriet. There are a number of programs that idealize suburban life in the 1950s, both reflecting what the lives that people in suburbs are leading, at least allegedly, or the aspiration of those lives, an idealized version of them, or shaping the expectations of people who live in suburbs. As of the 1950 census, I think it is, more Americans live in suburbs than either cities or rural areas. Now, there are more people in cities and rural areas than suburbs, but of the three kind of categories, the suburbs have more residents than any of the others. And so this is a growing phenomenon, and it's reflected in the culture. It will be reflected in the counterculture by the late 60s, but we get other suburban, I've been thinking about manifestations of commentary on suburban life that we see in television. I mean, the Dick Van Dyke Show is very.
I was thinking about this earlier. Like there's more examples of this than there are sort of examples of people living in other scenarios, right?
Yeah, that's right.
I was just thinking about sort of television shows that sort of follow on that mold that you were talking about with, Leave It to Beaver.
Yeah, the Brady Bunch.
The Brady Bunch, which is in the 60s. You've got things like when I was growing up, the Wonder Years.
Yes, which idealized it. Years and Happy Days reflected back on.
Exactly. So there was, and it was made in some ways for families to watch, where the people who are the parents in the, I guess this would have been the late 80s, early 90s for the Wonder Years, sort of my parents' generation who grew up in the suburbs, and sort of reflecting back on their own childhood.
Well, think of the title. But the title itself tells
itself you. Is wonder. Exactly. And more recent stuff that sort of, Married with Children, which obviously is a very different kind of suburban thing, but it's still sort of playing on those tropes.
Roseanne,
Modern Family, all these things are, built on the sort of archetype or responding to, the sort of archetype of the suburban nuclear family.
David, I've got two examples. The two best programs, I think, that actually satirize suburban life and are actually quite subversive.
Yes.
And bear me out on this, they're actually quite similar, are The Flintstones.
Okay.
Which definitely presents a view of suburban life in the 19, in Bedrock in the 1960s.
Yes.
And The Sopranos. And in fact,
okay.
Fred Flintstone and Tony Soprano have a lot in common. That they're both kind of besieged, bedraggled, suburban patriarchs who aren't really that good at being patriarchs. But I during lockdown, I've been rewatching The Sopranos, and there's a wonderful episode when Tony Soprano he's at breakfast and their daughter Meadow comes up, and she's talking about at that point the Bill Clinton sex scandal. It's the late 90s, 1999 or 2000 when this episode was made. And Tony says, "Hey, we don't talk about that kind of stuff here." And Meadow says, "Oh, come on, Dad, it's the 90s, the president's doing it. This is," and Tony Soprano says, "It might be 1999 out there, but in here it's 1954." And it's a very the Sopranos is really about suburban life in New Jersey. And in fact, the contrast between the city, which is seen as both a place of opportunity but also a threat, is part of that. And so the cultural manifestations of the suburbs in television is I'm sure there have been many dissertations written about it, but go back, watch Leave It to Beaver, watch The Flintstones, watch The Sopranos. You'll learn a lot about this, more than you will from listening to us.
I was struck, it's you mentioned the Flintstones, and we're reminiscing about television shows. When I was a child, they used to air the Flintstones and the Jetsons right next to back to back.
Well, they were siblings, really, as Hanna-Barbera cartoons.
Cartoons, right. And of course, one is about a suburban family in the Stone Age with dinosaurs, and one is about a suburban family in the far future. And they're basically interchangeable. The sort of family dynamics of those two families are the same. And so there's an essence of trying to sort of naturalize and universalize what was actually a very particular experience, but to try to say, look, it's always been like this, it will always be like this, when in fact the sort of suburban landscape that those things are drawing from actually only happens at a very particular moment and doesn't last forever.
No, that's right. I mean, they are very much of the moment. I mean, I'll look it up right now, but I bet those cartoons were made in the 1960s, maybe early 70s at the latest.
That sounds right.
And you know, they're a snapshot of suburban life, you know, as it's changing.
Yeah. You know, and one of the sort of, I guess...
The Flintstones began in 1960 and ran for 6 seasons.
So
it's earlier than I thought, and I will look up the Jetsons. Anyway, carry on, David.
Well, I mean, the other thing that, you know, thinking about what these, you know, suburbs are is this sort of, you know, thinking about how they sort of manifest themselves in popular culture. They are both these sort of sanitary, safe places for families to do family things. But they're also, you know, there's a version of suburbs in popular culture that are deeply scary, subversive places. You know, and I'm thinking about here about like Stepford Wives, kind of model of what suburbs do to people. They make people into sort of automatons that are, you know, lose their free will. And the suburbs are potentially actually, you know, have this dark underbelly to them.
Yeah, well, there's a whole kind of genre within kind of both film noir and in detective novels of a noirish turn that are about kind of the sinister aspects of the suburbs. And Mad Men captured some of that, actually.
Oh, to be sure. Right. So how have suburbs, you know, if this is sort of the we've been talking both about the sort of reality of suburban life in the 50s and 60s, and its sort of cultural manifestations. How have suburbs changed? You know, if Trump seems to be thinking about the suburbs in this very particular, potentially antiquated, probably antiquated way, how are suburbs different now than the suburbs that you grew up in?
Happy to address that, but just by way of explanation, the Jetsons premiered in 1962 and was on for 3 seasons. So the Flintstones
and
the Jetsons are contemporaneous, and the Jetsons didn't run as long as the Flintstones. I mean, the Jetsons basically took the Flintstones model, you're right, and set it in the far future in space. But so how have suburbs changed? I mean, most fundamentally, I think they've changed in two ways, both for the better. They've become much more diverse ethnically and racially. The kind of covenants and redlining that was used to exclude non-white people from the suburbs have fallen away. De facto segregation still exists, I think, in a lot of areas, but they've become much more diverse. They've also become more developed. They've almost become they've developed a lot of the attributes of cities. So they have a lot, you know, I remember there were, you know, there were no good bookstores in the suburbs when I was a kid. Now there are, bookstores, coffee shops, you know, the kind of measures, the suburbs have become, but it's in part because they've become diverse, but they've also become more diverse as far as the kind of cultural and economic opportunities they afford, I think much more so than they used to be. So I think as a consequence of that, there are a lot of people who live in suburbs who never have to go into the neighboring metropolitan center. But I think they've become both more diverse in ethnic and racial terms, but also more diverse in terms of the kind of economic activity that's being carried out in them. What do you think, David?
Well, I think you're definitely right about sort of the racial diversity of some of these suburbs. You know, I'm thinking about the suburb I lived in North Carolina, you know, which was built in 1960, so right at the sort of same time that Levittown was built. You know, and was originally built with these, you know, restrictive covenants, you know, and which actively tried to keep African Americans and other minorities out of the community. You know, they'd establish, you know, when an African American family looked into buying a house, they actually at various points established committees to try to sort of dissuade them from doing it with some subtly implied threats of violence. You know, and the White Citizens Council sort of met there and all these kinds of things. You know, by the time I moved in, obviously these houses were older and slightly less desirable. And so it wasn't the sort of upper middle class neighborhood it once was, and was now, you know, a kind of working class neighborhood with large numbers of immigrants. In fact, I think of our little cul-de-sac, and a cul-de-sac, of course, is sort of the epitome of a suburban lifestyle, I guess. We were the only sort of white married family there with children, you know, and so whereas Levittown was almost entirely composed of young married couples with children, you know, and Parkwood was the same way in the 1960s, we were the only, you know, it changed fairly dramatically where there's a large number of immigrant communities, both from Latin America and from Asia and from other places, a large number of African Americans who lived there, and so it was a much more diverse community. That being said, you know, so some suburbs have become much more diverse, and the sort of the racial profile of suburbia generally is different than it was. Yeah, there, one of the effects that suburbanization has is that people do tend to live alongside people who are of a fairly similar socioeconomic level or as they are. You know, if you think about sort of the gated communities that were built in the 80s and 90s, you know, they are very much designed, you know, where everybody there is within a particular sort of bracket. And I think that's a potentially quite problematic, because I mean, I think one of the things we've seen in the past 30 years is this sort of great sort that's happening in the United States, where people are increasingly living not only next to people who have similar, you know, financials, abilities that they do, but also people have similar sort of political and social views that they do. And these communities have become sort of reflections of that in some way. So you will have Republican suburbs and Democratic suburbs, and they'll be very different places, and where you'll be surrounded by people who are very similar to you, even if they are diverse in some ways, they are also not diverse in other ways. And I think that's a sort of consequence of suburbia. Cities have gotten a lot nicer than they used to be.
That's true.
You know, a lot of these cities that were hollowed out in the 50s and 60s that sort of led to the urban crisis and all these things, these, you know, the process of, you know, revitalization of urban centers, of reusing old factories, and they're now into, you know, lofts and condos and what have you. That whole process has made urban life that much more exciting and interesting, you know, thinking about sort of what has become of Brooklyn, or what has become of, you know, inner city places that were at one point quite, you know, depressed economically, are now vibrant in a way that they weren't. And so
yes,
I think the relationship between the suburbs
that's passed Donald Trump by, because the way he describes inner cities is always as inner city hellholes, and he's missed out on that as well.
Which is very odd, given that he lives in or spent his entire adult life in a city.
Yes, yes. But he's 50 floors up and drives everywhere in a limousine, so he never really experiences the city, I guess.
That is true. Right. I mean, I think suburbs today are very different kinds of places, and I'm not sure that his description of this sort of suburban lifestyle dream is necessarily in accordance with what's actually going on.
Well, and I think, David, if I may, the gender dimension of this, both in terms of his rhetoric and the way the suburbs have changed, is really important. So he, you know, when he, in his appeal that you mentioned at the top of this episode to suburban housewives, again, that's a very 1950s orientation. It's June Cleaver, and that's simply not true anymore. And so another way the suburbs have changed, which perhaps we should have given more emphasis to, is in terms of, it's not just that diversity of economic activity that I mentioned, but it's also who's doing it. The kind of old suburban model of the idealized one, which was never entirely reality, of the kind of male breadwinner going in, you know, commuting into the city on the train, and, you know, coming home to a housewife who doesn't work, that's simply not true anymore. I mean, the world of work has changed dramatically, but, you know, we have most suburbs now, or in many suburbs, the norm will be, you know, both parents, if it's a family, if it's a couple with children, working and so on. And so the world of work and the world of work in the suburbs the gender dimension of that has changed tremendously as well.
And I think one of the other sort of big differences between suburban life today and suburban life in 1950, the prices of housing has radically shifted, right? And so whereas, you know, you can get the Levittown starter house for $8,000, you know, in many communities, the availability of any housing that's affordable to you know, young couples is basically non-existent. And so I think the sort of barrier to entry is very different than it used to be. And I think that changes the compositions of these neighborhoods.
Yes, and in affluent suburbs, with the advent of so-called McMansions, you know, it's Levittown on steroids. You know, these massive homes that are really, really, you know, cost millions and millions of dollars.
Yeah, so the Levittown houses, the at least the initial ones, were under 10,000 square feet, you know, and now we're getting people buying houses that are, you know, 100,000 square feet.
Yeah.
Have you. So huge monstrosities of things. Right.
So before we close, David, do you think Donald Trump's outreach to the suburbs, and we'll have to talk about the election eventually, but do you think his outreach to the suburbs and the way he's done it, you know, appealing to housewives, threatening that Cory Booker's coming, do you think this will be successful?
The threat of Cory Booker coming notwithstanding, you know, suburbs are one of the few places where you have swing voters in as much as those things exist anymore. And so I think, you know, this particular targeting of suburbs is trying to, you know, find a way to persuade those few voters who are still persuadable, you know, to vote for him. So, but, you know, the number of people who, when he's talking about suburban housewives, think people who hear he's thinking about me in that respect is far fewer people than he thinks it is. And so I'm not quite sure it's going to be persuasive.
Hold on, David. One of the groups that he's particularly worried about that he needs, that where Biden's cut into his lead, is in voters over 65. And so to some extent, they may share his view of the suburbs, even if it's an inaccurate one.
Oh, that's true. I mean, although I think both candidates are doing that. I mean, Biden released an ad about the same time as the convention that had him fawning over a 1950s car.
Yes. Yep.
You know, which in a driveway, and it very much sort of evoked that similar kind of vision of American suburban life, that is largely an artifact of history and not a reality anymore. So I think both of them, if they're seeing that as a potential, you know, voting demographic that they can you know, attract, I think that, you know, I guess the electoral politics makes some sense. I'm not sure how persuasive either of them are going to be necessarily, but I guess we'll find out in November.
Indeed.
Great. I think it's time for last drops. So do you have a last drop for us, Frank?
I do. I want to recommend a book. It's not a new book. It came out in 2012. But it's called Out of My League by Dirk Hayhurst. And Dirk Hayhurst was a journeyman. He wasn't even a journeyman, really. He was kind of a peripheral pitcher in baseball. He had a very brief major league career with the, if memory serves, the San Diego Padres, the Toronto Blue Jays, and the Tampa Bay Rays. And he was a relief pitcher, and he wrote a book in 2009 or 10 called The Bullpen Gospels. And the book I want to recommend that I'm currently reading is called Out of My League. It's a kind of sequel to The Bullpen Gospels. And the reason I want to recommend it is he's got a really good authorial voice. He's writing in the first person. It's more or less a memoir. But what he talks about is his experience, especially early in the book, his experiences when he met his wife and he's in the minor leagues and he's struggling to come up. But it gives a portrait of he's from Ohio originally, and there are real elements, and I'm not being facetious here, there are real elements of hillbilly elegy in it. And hillbilly elegy, of course, got all kinds of attention after the 2016 election. But it's kind of hillbilly elegy with a lot of baseball and less earnestness. He's quite funny. So it's almost like hillbilly elegy meets Ball Four, if you remember the Jim Booten's classic book, you know, diary about baseball, the New York Yankees in the 60s. It's a very entertaining book. It's very funny. But as I said, there's more to it than that, because he gets real insight into what it was like to struggle at the turn of the last decade. You know, before his contract got picked up and he knew he was, you know, going to make some money, you know, he's sleeping on an inflatable mattress on his grandmother's floor, and she's doesn't like his lifestyle. It's Out of My League by Dirk Hayhurst. If you're looking for a quick read that's more than it seems and it's very entertaining, I can recommend it.
Oh, wonderful. Okay.
What about you, David?
My wife and I have been watching a comic book based television program, which is I find a lot of fun and kind of a healthy escape from everything. It's called Umbrella Academy. Have you seen this, Frank?
I have not.
It's on Amazon. It's on Netflix. My apologies. It's basically like X-Men, but if you imagine Professor X being an abusive father. So the children with superpowers all grew up to be sort of slightly maladjusted as a consequence. And it's both sort of, it's funny, but it's got some good action in it. It's got a little bit of everything. And it doesn't have a huge, comic backstory. So if you haven't sort of actually read the comic, it's one of those things where you can actually, you know, watch it. The historical element to it, if there is one, season two involves the 1960s. There's some time travel shenanigans and all other kinds of fun things. But there's some good suburban life, or at least comic book depictions of what suburban life in the 1960s would have looked like. So I want to recommend The Umbrella Academy as a escape from all the things. The second season just came out on Netflix. Good fun.
Excellent. Oh, David, right. I'm just seeing a headline. Again, this kind of relates to mine, but Tom Seaver just died.
Tom Seaver, yes, I saw that, yes.
I didn't realize that. I hadn't looked at the headlines this morning, but I'm seeing that. And Tom Seaver, of course, was a great – he was only 75, great pitcher for the Miracle Mets in particular in the late 1960s, but kind of an iconic figure. So that's a show.
No, he was a great pitcher and a broadcaster afterwards, and seemed to be a decent guy.
I saw him late in his career.
He played for the Red Sox.
He played for the White Sox against the Red Sox. God, in the early 80s, it was freezing that night, but he wasn't. Yeah, anyway. Rest in peace, Tom Seaver.
All right. On that note, Frank, I'll talk to you next week. Cheers.
Okay, cheers, David.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod, and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.